I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about an event, a big event in the history of World War II that has a great significance for America, for the American military, and American history, and by the way, became an absolutely terrific movie, one of my favorites of all time. we're going to be talking today about Operation Market Garden. And I'm joined for that conversation by Chris Lewis. Chris is Vice President for Operations at the National Infantry Museum and Soldier Center. And he himself was a Command Sergeant Major of the 1st Battalion, 50th Infantry. He knows what he's talking about when we're talking about military operations, in particular, this very important military operation in World War II, which has probably been understudied and underappreciated, and we wanted to bring it to our listeners' attention for the 80th anniversary of it. Chris, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Hey, thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to everybody today about a battle that is near and dear to my heart, because just like you, the movie definitely sparked an interest as a young man way back when, seeing the jump sequences and the battle itself. And I was born on the 17th of September in 1968. So I was kind of destined to be, I think, an airborne guy because of that.
Well, all right. Some of our listeners, as you know, we have historically minded folks who are listening, but even historically minded folks may not know what Operation Market Garden was, or if they've heard of it, they don't know a lot about it. Just take us back to that time in World War II, the year, the context, why Operation Market Garden?
Okay, so let's kind of set the conditions for the topics and things we're going to talk about Market Garden. So, of course, by the beginning of September of 1944, we had two fronts in France. Of course, the D-Day landings on the 6th of June in Normandy, and then Operation Dragoon, which was the Allied invasion of southern France, happens on the 15th of August, 1944. So now we have two fronts pushing the Germans out of France as we continue to sweep through the country and push the Germans out of France. There was a pervasive feeling, I think, amongst a lot of the senior Allied planners and leaders that we had the Germans on their heels. They had been attrited to the point where maybe some of their more effective frontline units and divisions were now not at 100% strength. They were at 70 or 60 or even 50% strength. And they weren't as an effective fighting force because we had been kicking the you-know-whats across France. And we wanted to get the war in its fourth year. And I'm sure the Allies, Americans, Brits, everything, all the Commonwealth countries wanted the war to be over. So they came up with a lot of plans and ideas what was the quickest way to get to Berlin? One of the biggest things was to be able to cross the Rhine River, which has been for centuries. That's what kind of protected Germany, protected its western flank as a country, was this massive river. So how could we seize a bridgehead or bridges to get across the Rhine River, and that way be able to bring the massive firepower of our infantry and armored units from both the Americans and the British and the Commonwealth forces, into the heart of Germany and end the war. So everybody was excited about it, and plans after plans were, and the funny thing is, if you look at it objectively, there were quite a few plans involving use of airborne forces that were scrapped because literally the objectives that they were planned for guys to jump on, by the time they would get to the airfield and start getting ready to shoot up and get on an airplane, the Allies had seized those objectives. So there's just a big pervasive feeling like if we keep after it and we keep the logistics going and we can get after them, we can end the war before Christmas.
And of course, that's important too. I'm thinking about sort of the Eastern Front, right? Because now that it looks like Germany is collapsing and going to eventually lose, the Allies have to think not about just ending World War II, but what's the post-war world going to look like? And of course, the Soviets, right, are coming in from the East, making progress in the East as well.
Yeah, and I think too, the other thing folks have to realize is it wasn't just the ground war that was being fought on two fronts. Remember, the air campaign was absolutely relentless. The 8th Air Force and the 9th, our U.S. 8th, 9th, and 12th Air Forces were attacking from England, North Africa, and Italy into Germany and targets and by day. And then the Royal Air Force was bombing by night. So, I mean, they were just getting pummeled at this point. And again, just kind of led to that whole thinking that, hey, let's end this once and for all.
So the Allies have a successful D-Day invasion. They've pushed east toward the Rhine River. As you say, they've got to get across the Rhine so they can punch into Germany and end the war and maybe get to Berlin before the Soviets or around the same time as the Soviets. And they think, hey, and we can do this. So Operation Market Garden, who comes up with this and what actually do they propose?
So Market Garden was actually... there were some plans. It's kind of based on what was previously known as Operation Comet. And Comet wasn't approved for a myriad of reasons. And Operation Comet was supposed to be conducted on the 10th of September. Operation Comet very quickly became Operation Market Garden. And really the author of that entire operation is Bernard Montgomery, who is commander Sir General Bernard Montgomery of the 21st Army Group. This was his brainchild, and they literally came up with the plan on the 10th and they executed on the 17th. It was to be the largest airborne operation seen yet of the Second World War. In many cases, it still is in the history books, although Operation Varsity in March of 1945 is the largest single-day airborne operation. Market Garden is the largest operation conducted over a series of days, just the amount of men, material, equipment, aircraft, all that kind of stuff. So the base plan of what Market Garden was going to be is that the first Allied Airborne Army, which was led by Lieutenant General Lewis Brereton, was chomping at the bit to get into the fight. And that was basically utilizing the British 1st Airborne Division, the 82nd Airborne Division, the 101st Airborne Division, and the Polish Independent Parachute Brigade. They're going to seize a series of bridges across a 64-mile salient into the Netherlands with the actual prize being seizing the bridge across the Lower Rhine in Arnhem. And the deal was the paratroops would jump in, seize these key bridges, and then the British Second Army, made of 7 Corps, 12 Corps, and 30 Corps, 30 Corps being the vanguard, would literally drive up this route, crossing each of these bridges to get to Arnhem, get across the bridge, and into Germany. Now, bold plans, a lot of bold initiative is what kind of makes things happen, especially in combat operations. But the fact that the road itself was a 2-lane road and you're moving, and I did some little bit of math, they were going to move basically about 10 divisions worth of vehicles on a 2-lane road, 64 miles inside, enemy held territory.
So for our listeners who aren't military people, 10 divisions, how many soldiers are we talking about?
So for British, but best guesstimate, your typical armored division for the British Army would be anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 soldiers with their vehicles, weapons, and equipment. So you're talking about a massive amount of vehicles going up in most cases, a 2-lane road. And just think of things, the logistics of fuel for those vehicles and feeding those men and ammunition and all that kind of stuff. So again, it was a very bold plan, but I think as a lot of us agree with the title of the book and of the film, it was a bridge too far.
So let's talk about that a little bit. Bernard Montgomery, obviously a famous World War II British general, famous for being brilliant and certainly famous for himself thinking he was brilliant.
Right.
Notoriously difficult personality.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about the author of Market Garden, Bernard Montgomery.
So Montgomery's very interesting as officer and leader in the British Army. He came from aristocracy and he fancied himself, like you said, he was probably his own number one fan, but he was always a competitive officer and wanting to be able to seize objectives. If he could finish a mission or accomplish or seize an objective before the U.S. could, he was going to do it. So there was that amount of rivalry, and you can see it very clearly during Operation Husky, when the invasion of Sicily in July 1943, as him and General Patton raced across the island of Sicily to capture Palermo and Messina and the key cities. Montgomery wasn't too happy. After it was in the plans for the invasion of Normandy, one of the things agreed on before that is at some point Eisenhower was going to assume control of all Allied forces in the European theater. And when he did that in the summer of 44, Montgomery really didn't like that. Montgomery thought he should remain in command of everything, but Eisenhower was the supreme commander for all Allied forces. So there was some friction there. There was also, he thought he should have the priority to lead the attack against Germany and to end the war. And an interesting point that I realized reading last night was there was an article I read where Churchill was very clear to Montgomery at this point in the war that he should do whatever he can do to get the war over sooner rather than later. Because remember, at this point, the entire Commonwealth, all the Commonwealth nations, the United Kingdom, had been fighting basically since September, since 1939. And if Great Britain was going to remain great after the World War II was over, they need to have people. They need to have men that were able to do that. So there was a lot of pressure on him, I think, between his own kind of cocky attitude that, everything he does is perfect. And then, pressure from Churchill. Very, very interesting. Brings out a very interesting leader for the British forces during this time frame.
So how does, as you said, the Operation Market Garden starts on September 17th, I think you said, and the plan is created in September 10th.
Right.
That's only a week. How in the world did the command staff, I'm assuming, for example, Dwight Eisenhower has to approve it or at least be informed of it. How in the world does something that significant with so many troops and equipment and tanks and trucks and a giant air parachute landing, how in the world does that get approved in a week?
Well, again, there were base plans. If you remember earlier in the discussion, I was talking about how there had been other plans previous to Market Garden that didn't go because they literally, Allied vehicles overran the drop zones before they could get in the airplanes.
So the Allies were already contemplating a massive airdrop.
Right. So the framework was there. What had to change, and I mean, that's in my experiences, in the 31 years I worked for the organization as a retired Sergeant Major and put my operations hat on, I mean, things change. Intelligence change, units move, all that kind of stuff. But so you're not necessarily writing an entire new plan. You're just modifying an existing one. So the base framework and the other key thing was the logistics. They were launching everything out of England. So the airfields and the aircraft and remember, and the other thing too, guys, for folks to realize, a lot of these, the troop carrier groups, the C-47 in the photo behind me, a lot of these pilots and units in the airlift units already had experiences, a lot of experience in dropping paratroopers and flying and navigating, because a lot of these the guys that dropped on D-Day also probably a lot of those units dropped during Dragoon and now they're getting ready to drop for Market Garden. Now, the other key thing, this is also the first, well, I shouldn't say the first time, but it would be the largest daytime combat jump. Now, we enjoyed aerial superiority at this point, so we knew we could cover the aircraft, even though it was a daytime jump. So that, you know, that would bode well during the operation for a good concentration of the paratroops and gliders landing on the correct drop zones and landing zones near their objectives. So there was, but again, that framework was all there. So to be able to do it, yeah, I mean, it's still insane to be able to do an operation in 7 days, but they were able to do it.
And Eisenhower was convinced this is a good move, and maybe even a knockout punch or a body blow against Germany.
And I think between a combination of that and then his forces that were already pushing through France, you know, there's another discussion that comes up when you read about market guarding and the lead up to it of fuel was a big problem. The petroleum and fuel, all those products that for those mechanized infantry and armored divisions in France to continue their push both through the middle and the south of France in their campaigns, you know, most of that fuel was still coming over landing beaches at Normandy. So you hear, when you hear the terms of Red Ball Express, I mean, they were worth their weight in gold being able to get that, but that's, you get a look at the logistics aspect of it and who gets a priority in fuel, who gets priority on ammunition and replacements and vehicles and parts. And so Eisenhower kind of had to balance all that. And I really think he believed that maybe appeasing Montgomery with this plan he convinced him it would be a good plan. And again, putting more pressure on the Germans on a new front through the Netherlands. And I'm sure there was also a lot of concern for the well-being and of the Dutch people who had been subjugated under the German Third Reich for 4 years.
All right, so let's talk a little bit more then about how Operation Market Garden was carried out.
Okay, so the basic plan of Market Garden was gonna be a two-prong assault. Market would be the airborne component of the operation, and Garden being the land component of the operation. So from a series of airfields in the Midlands of England, there was going to be a phased parachute drop on several different objectives in and around the cities of Eindhoven, Nijmegen, and Arnhem. Now, these drop zones would be situated near these bridges that needed to be seized in that 64-mile salient that I spoke of earlier. And the order of march as far as from south to north, with Arnhem being the northernmost objective. So the 101st objectives, they would jump between noon and 1300 hours around the cities of Sonn, Veghel, and Eindhoven. That's where their bridge objectives were. The 82nd Airborne Division would be a little bit farther north, on drop zones near Grave and Nijmegen to seize those bridges. And then the British 1st Airborne, along with the Polish Independent Parachute Brigade, would drop for the key prize, which was the bridge at Arnhem over the Rhine River. Simultaneously, the Brits would, the 21st Army Group, would conduct their piercing of the Dutch-French border with 30 Corps in the lead, with three divisions led by the Guards Armored Division. And they would begin there fighting their way up that 64-mile route eventually get to Arnhem. And the fact it was a daytime, like I said earlier, it was a daytime drop. They actually didn't really take too many casualties on the initial drop. There were some anti-aircraft fire and some aircraft were damaged and shot down. In fact, I know a guy personally that was, Lieutenant Colonel Bob Chisholm, a friend of mine who lived in El Paso, who jumped into Normandy in Holland. But Bob said he was a young corporal and actually caught a piece of shrapnel when he went out the door of his C-47 on the 17th, which was a Sunday. Didn't realize until he got on the ground, real tiny piece, but he was like, "Hey, what's this blood stain in my arm?" And he was like, "Well, son of a gun."
Wow. So we have simultaneously, you say, the three main drops for the paratroopers,
right,
at Eindhoven, Nijmegen, and Arnhem, and then we have 30 Corps leading the armored piercing to link up with all of
right.
them. For just to give our listeners a sense of the scope of the operation, the airborne operation, you said it's the largest overall airborne operation. How many paratroopers dropped?
So from, I'll put it to you this way. Each division, the 82nd and the 101st, had about 14,000 paratroopers drop into to their drop zones, again, near Eindhoven and Nijmegen. But remember, they also got glider troops. So they had about 8,000 glider troops combined between both divisions, also land on objectives. Gliders is how you got your heavy equipment in, your jeeps, your artillery pieces, generator sets. We actually had, they had bulldozers and other heavy equipment. The Brits had a total of 12,000 going at Arnhem, and about a third of those were also glider troops as well. So you're talking, you know, close to, I mean, 40,000 or you know, 35 to 40,000 airborne troops going into those objectives at the same time.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
It's amazing. I think some of our listeners are thinking, boy, this is 1944.
Right.
What's it like? And you've got that amazing C-47 behind you there. What's it like in 1944 to jump out of an airplane in a combat situation?
So he is during daytime, too.
So yeah, let's add that.
Right. So I've been blessed to have been able to jump from a C-47 a few times. On a side note, I'm a member of the World War II Airborne Demonstration Team out of Frederick, Oklahoma, and we have two of our own C-47s that we do demonstration jumps with. So think about riding in an airplane made out of aircraft aluminum for about 2 to 3 hour flight from England. You probably had some flak shot at you. The only thing separating you from, as you're getting ready to, I mean, just aircraft room, there's no armor in the aircraft. You're probably carrying about 100 pounds of equipment with the parachute, personal weapon, packing list. And then, you know, you're jumping things like they jumped bazookas, they jumped 30 caliber machine guns. Everything they're going to need on the ground would be jumped on them. The aircraft actually had bundles underneath. 2 to 4 bundles mounted underneath each aircraft, and that would have things like your heavier weapons, 81 millimeter mortars, the 75 millimeter pack howitzers, and additional supplies. So you can do a little quick math for your listeners. Your C-47s, normally during peacetime, a C-47, if you were here at Fort Moore going to jump school in 1944, it carried about 23 jumpers. But most of the aircraft going into Arnhem and Nijmegen and Eindhoven, excuse me, have maybe 18 to 20 jumpers on them, because there's this thing called fuel to weight ratio. So they knew those aircraft had to fly from England, drop in the Netherlands, and then get back. So how much weight could they put in the airplane and it still have enough fuel to fly that mission? So they don't go max capacity there, because again, each jumper is weighed down to the ounce, how much they weigh, and then the bundles and them. So the fuel to weight ratio becomes pretty clear. But with that, so say you have 20 jumpers, so do the math. If you had 13 to 14,000 paratroopers, then the massive amount of aircraft that we were able to put in the air, I would dare to say, I just did a presentation on Normandy for the 80th, and I did some research, and I think for the 505th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 82nd, my alma mater, I was in the 05 three different times in my career. The 05, when they go into Normandy, I think it took close to 370 aircraft just to bring the paratroopers in for that regiment. So that's a base number. And the 82nd for for Holland had the 504, the 505, and the 508. So they had three parachute infantry regiments. So that's easily, you know, almost 1,000 airplanes just to bring those three regiments into their respective drop zones. The logistics of it just blows my mind every time I think about it.
Oh, it's really amazing. The sky must have been absolutely filled with aircraft.
There's a little quick story I want to share. In 19, when I was stationed in Germany, I went to Grusbeek and Nijmegen and Arnhem in 1998 just to see all those great places. And there's a wonderful museum in Grusbeek, which is just to the southeast of Nijmegen, and it's an airborne museum. And one of the local Dutch volunteers spoke very good English, and he walked us around the museum. And then we stopped in the cafe and had a coffee, and there was a Roman Catholic priest, and his had to be in his 80s, that made the coffee for us and sat down. And he, I can't remember his name, but he in very, very good English, when I told him that I had been in the 82nd Airborne Division, he looked at me and he said, "I remember when you came." So there's a scene in A Bridge Too Far where it shows the Dutch were in a Roman Catholic church in Nijmegen. And all this, you know, and the Dutch underground was so well orchestrated and organized, the Germans would only allow the Dutch to congregate during church. That's the only time they were allowed to meet in groups. So the scene in the movie is you see they're having a church service, and then all of a sudden they hear, and they hear the C-47s, and they go outside and they see the gliders and the C-47s. Well, this gentleman was the Roman Catholic priest. That was a real true story.
Wow.
And he said, with a tear in his eye, he said, "I remember when you came." So imagine being under the thumb of the German occupation for 4 years, and on a Sunday church service, you hear airplanes and you look up and all you see are gliders and parachutes. I mean, just what an amazing moment to be able to share with that guy. It's really cool.
It's an incredible moment. The other thing that struck me from watching the movie, and I'm curious how historically accurate this is, because when you have that many planes flying over and there's so many of them and so many paratroopers dropping, again, I think our listeners are thinking, wait, there's no satellites guiding this.
No.
Nobody on the ground is sending up coordinates. It's just you fly over something and you jump out as best you can. How precise were the drops? How much danger was there just in jumping out and dropping for these paratroopers?
Right. I mean, there is. I mean, especially because it was a daytime jump. But because of that and because of the fact that our tactical Air Force, the 9th Air Force, was able to, you know, we had great fighter escort, and they had, as the aircraft went in, the drones were some of the most accurate that you'll see during the war, because the pilots could see their land recognition marks, and they were, as they came in, as they're looking at maps and following compasses and very basic rudimentary airmanship, but they were I read last night, just kind of freshen up things in my head, but I think all three of the parachute infantry regiments had over 90% of their troops landed on the actual drop zones that they were meant to be. Now, some gliders, the gliders did fare pretty well, but then some of the gliders, like this is just an unfortunate reality, tow ropes broke. Some of them unfortunately landed in the English Channel. Some of them landed a lot farther off from their intended landing zones. That's just a reality of war. But the actual drops themselves, because it was a complete surprise, the audacity for us to be able to do a daytime drop, I think, got kind of threw the Germans off as well, because every other parachute operation we'd done in Europe previous to that was always a nighttime jump.
Well, that's what I was going to wonder. Now that it's September 17th, as you say, flying over on a Sunday over church services, paratroopers start dropping. When they land, how does the operation go?
So for the 82nd, in general terms, for the 82nd and the 101st, the 101st did very well. They seized all of their objectives except one, the bridges that they were supposed to seize, right as they were getting up to the canal, I believe it was over the Saan River, the Germans blew it up right in front of them. So that kind of slowed the timetable is now in jeopardy. Now, let's go back and talk about 30 Corps. As they realize, you know, they're fighting their way up this route to get to these bridges. They're running into all types of obstacles. The Germans are putting up quite a fight, because then not only as they're going up the road, they have to fight through German defensive positions, they got to protect their flanks as they continue to push up this road. So the Germans are really giving more of a fight than they expected. That's thrown the timetable off. But back to the airborne portion. So the 82nd sees all of their objectives except one. I'm sorry, the 101st. 101st seizes all of their objectives except one. The bridge at Sonne is blown. They're quickly trying to get assets up there to repair the bridge. The 82nd jumps near Nijmegen. There was more of a concern. Groesbeek is to the southeast of Nijmegen, and it's a high ground that basically is right up against the German border. So General Gavin, Major General or Brigadier General Gavin, the commanding general of the 82nd Airborne Division for that operation, he gives the order to seize the Groesbeek Heights first before they go into Nijmegen to take the bridge, simply because he looked at the terrain, and if he was like, if the Germans get that high ground and put artillery on it or observers, we're going to be screwed trying to take the Nijmegen Bridge. But they have a plan to get in and attack. The Brits jump. When the British first airborne jumps in Arnhem, they start running into roadblocks almost as soon as they hit the ground. The closest drop zones literally were some of them were 4 to 8 miles away from the objective. They had a huge problem with the radios that they had at the time that didn't have the distance or the wattage to be able to talk between units. You remember this from the film, what the initial plan was, is that the first airborne would have 4 gun jeeps in a horse of gliders that would land, and they were going to race ahead to the Arnhem Bridge and seize it, waiting for the rest of the British paratroopers to march and get to the bridge. When the jeeps land, with gliders land with the jeeps in them, they got ambushed, and all the gun jeeps were either damaged or destroyed. So their timetable was off even before they even got anywhere near their objectives in Arnhem.
So everything obviously had to work as planned or as close to planned as possible. Right. And as you say, at Eindhoven, it seems to be working. At Nijmegen, a little less, and at Arnhem, even less.
Right.
And that's, of course, the most perilous one because it's the farthest from
exactly.
Inland, right?
Exactly.
The Allied lines. The German response, you've mentioned that the British armor ran into more German resistance than they expected. Why was that? Were the Germans, was there an intelligence failure? Were the Germans just more effective fighters with the forces they had? Did they have different forces than the Allies thought? How come the German resistance was fiercer?
Well, I think, again, there's some great publications out here that and books that talk about this. But again, it goes back to that pervasive feeling that we had the Germans on the run, that they were constantly in retreat. We were constantly putting pressure on them, and they were giving up a lot of the land that they had seized in Western Europe in the early part of the war. And there were intelligence. I mean, there are big gaffes. I mean, part of the intelligence network on the ground for the Dutch resistance had reported that they had told them that German units were in the area. They also did report some of their estimates that some of those units were only maybe 50 to 60% strength. And again, I just think in the vigor that Montgomery had to get this operation going, he assumed quite a bit of risk when it came to an intelligence analysis of not just how effective the German units were, but how many and what type were there. I mean, when you look at the German 7th Army, so Army Group B under Field Marshal Model is in the area, and the 7th Army that has the 1st SS Panzer Corps. Now, the 1st SS and 12th SS divisions were at 50% strength, but there's still two Panzer SS divisions, not to mention they had the 9th SS, 10th SS, which are almost at full strength, and the 6th Fallschirmjäger Regiment, which was a German parachute regiment. That's still a lot of guys that can pull triggers and have guns and tanks.
I'm assuming these are battle-hardened troops.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I just think we vastly underestimated the fight that they were going to put up at this part of the war.
Well, all right. So the book is called A Bridge Too Far. The movie's called A Bridge Too Far. It suggests that the Allies did go one too far. They went to Arnhem. They shouldn't have gone to Arnhem. Was this, in your estimation, a success, a failure, or somewhere in between?
I think overall, I think the mission was a success with some obvious huge shortcomings. So a success and a failure mixed in. Because here's the deal: all of the terrain that we seized, both the ASEC and the 101st, we never gave up. So that we managed to get as far as Nijmegen, and everything that 30 Corps and the rest of the 20 of the British Second Army, when they still fought their way and got to Nijmegen. But the proverbial bridge too far was, as is in the book and in the film, was Arnhem. The fact that it was a very tight timeline, and I really don't think there was a lot of leeway for what if this happens, you know, courses of action and how to be able to react to them. I mean, the failure part of it is, and this is just by sheer numbers, when you look at the fight at Arnhem, British First Airborne goes in with 12,000 paratroopers. They come out with less than four.
Wow.
I mean, they when you look at that fight, and it documents it very well in The Bridge Too Far, they were, when they, and remember, they were on the north side of the river. When they, because that's where this, you know, they were on the north side of the river. That part, it was where they seized the bridge. So they, I mean, they had elements on both sides, but again, they had to fight through they would have to fight through the city. And the Germans, I mean, they were experts at city fighting. You look at when they were, recording or trying to, here's where the front line of enemy troops were compared to the British soldiers. They were tracking it by buildings or by rooms in buildings. I mean, it was
so the fighting was that intense, that almost hand to hand.
Right. It got down to that. Those guys there, I mean, at the end of the day, they're still airborne guys. They don't have tanks and armored vehicles, and the weapons that they had with them were ones that were either airdropped or came in on gliders with them. So they were, it's a very dark day for the British First Airborne. But I mean, some of the most heroic fighting stories of fighting you're going to see or hear during the Second World War is what those guys were doing at Arnhem against the Germans.
Well, what is, as you say, it's a success in the sense that the Allies do advance. They do capture those two towns and those bridges. But of course, with terrible losses, as you're saying, to the British, but also, of course, to the other troops that are there. What is the effect of Operation Market Garden? First, in the immediate effect on the situation in World War II.
So the immediate effect, what it did was it really, I think it did two things. I think it galvanized the Germans in their fight. Like, they proved to us, like, they're still very much a force to be reckoned with, where, again, there was this permeating feeling like, oh, they're on the run, they're at 50% strength, they're wore out. Well, no, they really weren't. They were still a force to be reckoned with, and we were not to underestimate them if we were to continue being successful. Although we kind of did a few months later with the Battle of the Bulge, we won't get into that too much. But it also showed, I think, some shortfalls in planning that between amongst the Allies, particularly with Montgomery and Montgomery, General Eisenhower, Omar Bradley, and those guys, like, hey, we don't have the men and material to keep doing things like this. But you know, the success part of this is it gave the Dutch hope. I mean, we liberated a huge part of their country. And you know, I will tell you that if you ever go to Normandy or if you ever go to Holland, and meet folks, even today, they are still very grateful for what the Americans and the British and the Canadians, did to liberate them from the Third Reich. Well, same trip on Nijmegen, I was taking a picture with the Nijmegen Bridge in my background, and my ex-wife was taking the photo, and a car stopped, and they're just young kids, and they pulled up, and they said, oh, are you Americans? And I said, yes, and they said, thank you, and they drove off. I mean, that's just still how they are, which is just amazing.
And that really is amazing, the kind of lasting moral effect of it.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about the enduring lessons that the United States military learned, or more broadly, the political lessons from Operation Market Garden?
I think some of the broader things is the use and the effective ability for joint planning. What I mean by joint planning, that means from different countries that we can collaborate, and we still do that. I mean, with our great NATO partners and stuff for operations in Europe. Being able to work towards a common objective with a common goal, and not kind of splinter off into separate things, that being able to do things collectively, especially during combat operations, is more effective than doing it by yourself. It also highlights that at the end of the day, it comes down to the fighting abilities of those individual soldiers and paratroopers and glidermen. Training is always going to be number one. It's got to be tough. It's got to be realistic. It has to be day. It has to be night, and be able so that they're able to react to anything that's put in front of them, no matter what the enemy throws at you.
Well, that's amazing. It sounds exactly as you say. Operation Market Garden is kind of a study of planning, of strategy, but maybe ultimately of courage and of heroism,
right?
Of infantry soldiers.
One of the other stories, this is kind of a funny story. Again, I mentioned Colonel Chisholm, the gentleman I knew in El Paso that was at in Market Garden. So he was part of a patrol in the city of Nijmegen, the south side of the bridge. There's a traffic circle, and it's still there, where many of the roads from Nijmegen come to that traffic circle, and that's how you get onto the Nijmegen Bridge. And there's some 4 or 5 story apartment buildings around that. Chisholm was a corporal, and he had taken a few guys on a patrol to go up and see what the Germans had for defensive positions in and around the traffic circle. Well, the Germans had an 88 millimeter anti-tank gun in the middle of the traffic circle, and he could see German machine gun positions all in the roofs around the traffic circle. So he was like, okay. Turned around and started very quietly. They were moving back. Well, another patrol came up from a different company, and a guy named Angel Romero, who was also from El Paso and was good friends with Colonel Chisholm. They were like, well, hey, we're going up to the traffic circle. And Colonel Chisholm told him what they had up there. And he's like, and then we're in, and Angel Romero said, and we are now not going up the traffic circle. So individual units were setting up patrols, but just shows the common sense of a 19-year-old paratrooper, you know, still have a little humor in it. Yeah, you probably don't want to go up there.
Right. Amazing to be able to find humor in that kind of tough situation.
Yep.
Wow, Chris, this has been a fascinating look into, something I think that a lot of our listeners may have heard of but not known nearly as deeply, the richness and the importance of Operation Market Garden. Chris Lewis of the National Infantry Museum, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate the time. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.